Palm Sunday, we celebrate the triumphal entry. The triumphal entry is when Jesus enters into Jerusalem on the donkey. They're welcoming him as King of Kings, as Messiah. They recognize who he is, and they welcome him into Jerusalem. Of course, ironically, as the people of the Jewish people are welcoming Jesus in, they are thinking that Jesus is going to enter in as King of Kings, take over and reign with them, and finally overthrow the Roman government. They're still in that zone, and yet what Jesus is going to do is enter in, and then he's going to die on a cross, and all is going to be lost, except for the fact that he's going to be resurrected and redeem the entire planet in that process through his incredible work. So the people are welcoming in King of Kings, Lord of Lords. So it makes sense if we're going to be celebrating Palm Sunday today and celebrating the triumphal entry that we move out of Luke chapter 8 where we've been spending our time. We jump to the triumphal entry and we spend time there, except that's not what we're going to do at all. We're going to stay in Luke chapter 8 because the story we're about to get into in Luke chapter 8 displays the reality of the triumphal entry in many ways, the recognition of who God is and what he's doing in such a majestic way that I looked at it and I'm like, are you kidding me? We're right here. We're staying right here. This is going to be awesome. So just to give you guys a context of what's going on in Luke chapter 8 right now as we've been traveling through following the rabbi, right? Luke chapter 8, in the beginning, Jesus is telling parables or stories about the kingdom of heaven, about us, about how we relate to the kingdom of heaven and what our role is in this calling that he's given us. Then in the middle of Luke chapter 8, he switches and he starts living out certain particular moments in time that he's going to be demonstrating to his disciples certain realities that they need to know in order to live on mission. Then Luke chapter 9, verse 1, he's going to send the 12 disciples out into the world, giving them the authority to preach the good news, heal the sick, and cast out demons, the very thing that he is doing, and he's going to send them on mission. And then, of course, all of this part of his plan to prepare them for the huge reality that he is going to die, rise again, ascend into heaven, and send them out into the world as gospel carriers to display, demonstrate, and guard the gospel of Jesus Christ and become the hands and feet of the redemptive and reconciliation process that he began. So all of this in Luke chapter 8 is a preparation process through story. Parables at first, and then events that are stories in which Jesus is preparing them for the real reality of the everyday life they're going to live. And in preparing them, he is preparing us as Luke is inspired by the Spirit of God to place these stories in sequence in Luke chapter 8. So with no further ado, let us grab our Bibles and turn to Luke chapter 8 in our Bibles. If you don't have a Bible, under the seats there's a bunch of them. Grab one of ours, and if you don't have a good Bible at home, take one of our Bibles, write your name in it, take it home with you, keep it for yourself. Page 718 of our Bibles, Luke chapter 8. As you can tell, Luke chapter 8, the parables are there. Verse 19, we were in last week, where Jesus' mother and brother show up, and he declares to the crowd around him, "You are as much family to me as they are family to me." A huge declaration of the relationship that we have with Christ and the confidence we can have in what he is doing. And then in verse 22, we bump into this incredible story. It says, "One day, Jesus said to his disciples, 'Let's go over to the other side of the lake.'" Okay, so let's just stop there. The other side of the lake. Where are we going on this? What lake are we talking about here? This is the Sea of Galilee. It is called a lake here because the Sea of Galilee, though, when you hear that, sounds like a really huge body of water. It's actually not. From north to south, the Sea of Galilee stretches approximately 10 miles. And from east to west, or west to east, it stretches approximately 4.5 to 5 miles. So it is not a very big body of water. It's actually relatively small. If you stand on the side of the Sea of Galilee and it's a clear day, you can see from one side to the other with relative ease. And so there's a certain sense between the mountains that surround it that you have this lake that we call the Sea of Galilee. And in the northern point of this lake or sea is Galilee and Capernaum and all those places. The Galilean area or region is the conservative Jewish region of devout people that are trying to find a rabbi and become a disciple and follow them with, of course, some of the trades like fishing and carpentry and building and that kind of stuff. On the southern end of the Sea of Galilee, toward the east, you have Decapolis, the 10 cities, the Hellenistic mindset, the Roman and Greek philosophies, the infiltration of pagan, quote-unquote, life on that side. So you've got this body of water that separates the comfortable conservative Jewish life with the Hellenistic crazy pagan philosophies of the real world, right? And Jesus says to his boys, let's get in the boat and go to the other side of the lake. As much as it is a 8 to 10 mile travel, it's also one world to another. From the world of comfort and friends to the world of mission and reality, this is the lake drive they're about to take. Now, when Jesus says to the boys, we're heading over to the lake, this is what they would have been traveling in. Take a look. That's a little boat right there. In 1986, in a year where the Sea of Galilee was at its lowest point in hundreds of years, some people discovered an old-looking boat in the ground in the shallows. Archaeologists came and dug it up, and they dated it back to the time of Christ. This is not that boat. This is a replica of that boat. But this is exactly the size that that boat showed them, and it confirmed archaeological history that the size of the boats, this probably being one of the bigger ones on the Sea of Galilee, were about 26 feet long, 7.5 feet wide, with a mast in the middle, the oar on the back, the rudder on the back, and the oars. So these were the typical fishing and transportation boats. There were smaller versions, but this was probably our biggest version during the time of Jesus. On this boat, you'd have a crew of 4 people and a person handling the rudder, so that's 5, and then you could transport up to 10 more people on this boat. So 15 people in total could fit on that little boat. You go, no, they couldn't. Like, yeah, they could. It's not the safest thing, I'm sure, but that's what they did. Plus, recognizing and realizing that in the time of Jesus, the size of human beings were slightly different than our American wonders. And so there, generally, they were between 5 foot and 5 foot five. Those were the men, 140, 150 pounds. That was sort of the average size of a Jewish person back then. So if you put a couple of 140 pound guys on there, that's great. In America, you can fit like 3 people on the boat, right? So that was the boat they're headed over on. They all get on the boat, and it says this in the story, right? They're heading over to the other side of the lake. So they got into a boat and set out. As they sailed, he fell asleep. Who is he? Of course, Jesus, because they said Jesus said we're going to go over to the lake. So he falls asleep. Why does he fall asleep on the boat as they're heading across the Sea of Galilee to the other side, doing approximately an 8 to 10 mile journey across? Well, I'll tell you why. How many of you guys have ever been on the beach before? Raise your hands if you've been on the beach. Look at that, all of you. How many of you guys have fallen asleep on the beach, waking up as a red lobster going, what happened? Why didn't you wake me up, right? We always fall asleep on the beach. Why? Because the sun is shining and the waves are crashing and the quiet breeze is blowing and there's no better place to sleep than there, right? And the same thing happens when you get on a boat for a journey that is going to take a number of hours, because remember, even though that right there is the Sea of Galilee and you can see the other side, if you're heading down the Sea of Galilee, you are definitely going to be spending a number of hours on this boat. So they take off on a day probably very much like this in the earlier part of the day. They're sitting back. Jesus relaxes in the back of the boat, and he takes a nap. Totally appropriate. As they're heading down and Jesus is napping, it says this. It says a squall came down on the lake so that the boat was being swamped and they were in great danger. What? Okay, so do a little research on the Sea of Galilee, and this is what you find out. The Sea of Galilee is actually a very shallow lake at its deepest point, 200 feet deep, and it sits between mountains. So here's what happens with the Sea of Galilee. It is very common in this area for the air between the low-lying sea and the high top of the mountains to cause all sorts of havoc, and so storms with lots of wind can come up very fast, and they come off the mountains, come down onto the lake. They hit this body of water that is at its deepest point, 200 feet deep. For the most part, the entire body of water is shallower than that, and because it cannot absorb the energy of the wind coming across the lake, the squalls that hit this lake, when they come and they hit fast, they hit hard, and everything changes. You go from a beautiful day like this to a day more like this. Take a look. This is a painting that was painted, and this would describe the Sea of Galilee on a very stormy day in the middle of a massive squall. You can no longer see land anywhere. Waves are coming to the point where they're coming over the boat and they're entering into the boat. The winds have blown the water all over the place, and you are in the middle of a mess. The storms on the Sea of Galilee come around that bend in the Sea of Galilee like storms in Florida appear. How many of you guys have been out on the lakes before? And you head out, say, noonish, and it's a beautiful day, not a cloud in the sky. And about 2:30 p.m., you look over your shoulder and someone goes, "You see that?" And we turn around and there's that dark, foreboding sense. And you go, "Oh, we got some time." And then 23 minutes later, you're trying to tie your boat down in a lightning storm going, "What happened?" Welcome to Florida, right? It's the same thing here. When those things come, they come hard, they come fast, and you're in the middle of them. So even if you're in the middle of the lake and you divert to try to head to the side of the lake, oftentimes you get caught in the squall. Now, the guys on the boat, remember who's on the boat, right? They're in the middle of the squall. The boat has 13 people on it, so it's at its almost maximum level. Water's coming into the boat. You've got guys like Peter on the boat. What does Peter do for a living? He fishes. Where does he fish? On the Sea of Galilee. I mean, this is relatively normal day for Peter, right? So I don't know how this thing played out, but you got to ask questions like, when they saw the storm, why didn't they turn? Or, but you know, you got Peter on the boat. And the two brothers of Zebedee, right? I mean, you got John and James there. These guys are fishermen. This is what they do. If Jesus said we're going to the other side of the lake, oh, it's a pathetic little storm. We'll just buzz on through it. You got Matthew on the boat, guys like that. No tax collectors. I mean, water is bad. I don't swim well. I don't like water. When there's a storm, I hate it. So, you know, you got a group of guys on the boat that you got to admit it's gonna make for an interesting scenario. So they buzz through. They're in the middle of a massive storm. We're not quite sure how they got there other than it came fast and probably Peter said, "We're doing this." And now they're in the boat, and guess what Jesus is doing? He's sleeping, folks. Okay, look at that picture. Who sleeps through that? I want to know, right? I don't think anybody does. So when I die, I've got a little list of questions. One of them is this: Jesus, I want to know, were you asleep or were you pretending? I just want to know, because I don't really care. If you were asleep, that's incredible. If you were pretending, that's awesome. Either way is a win for me. I just want to know which one it was. But one way or the other, the guys definitely experienced Jesus as asleep on the boat, okay? So eventually, you hear this come out in the story. The disciples went and woke him, saying, "Master, Master, we're going to drown." Now, I love when they say the disciples. I mean, what does that mean? Did all of the guys do that? I doubt it. I bet that Matthew and Peter were fighting over waking Jesus up, and Peter said, "Leave him alone, we're fine." Matthew's going, "We're going to die." And so finally, the disciples, like one of them, like, "Jesus, wake up." I don't know what they wanted from him, other than I would guess they were fighting and they needed Jesus to get up and make some decisions. Because Peter's being stupid and Matthew just wants to get out and nobody seems, and so it's like, "Jesus, wake up. Well, there's a storm. We're going to die. We're going to drown." And Jesus wakes up out of his slumber, either in pretense or reality. And as he wakes up, these are the first words that come out of his mouth. It says, he got up and rebuked the wind and the raging water. Let's just stop there for a second. Does that weird you out? Oh, I know. You've grown up in church, so you know the story. And you're like, "Oh, no, that's everyday stuff in the Bible, right? Jesus wakes up, he rebukes the storm." Who gets up out of a boat in that and goes, "Quiet, everybody"? I mean, that's just stupid, right? Except for the fact that in this particular case, as Jesus sits up and he rebukes the storm, the Bible says the storm subsided and everything was calm. Let me explain to you my best experience of that. Have you ever been in a car with more than 3 small children? I have, every day, right? And because the car is moving at a high rate of speed, you cannot throw them out of the car while moving. So you're pretty much trapped in the car until such a time where you can stop the car, right? So you're driving and it escalates. It's like a storm. It starts with a little fight, then it starts getting louder. Then this one throws something and hits that one in the head. You're concentrating on the road so you don't kill all of them, though you're thinking that might be a better way to go right now. And you're going, and so you start turning the radio up, right? And you're turning it up and you're turning it up and they're getting louder. And then in the noise, you hear a muffled shout from the back of the car. "Dad!" through the noise. And you think, one of my kids is trying to get my attention, I think. So you wait long enough to see if maybe they'll just give up because it's too loud, but they don't. So now it's starting to get interesting. And in that moment, I do what I call rebuking the storm, right? I turn around, I turn the radio off, and I go, "Everyone quiet!" And everything goes, whoom. And for about 30 seconds, I've got a moment there, and I go, "What is it, Cole? Dad, I need this." "Okay, you got it." And then I turn the radio back on because the storm is a-brewing again, right? That's rebuking a storm into perfect peace for a second. That's the best I've got. Jesus gets up in a boat in that, and he says a word, and everything is still. Let me just give you a clear picture of what that means when the Bible says he rebuked the storm and everything was at peace. You see that wave that they're going into there? I mean, just imagine for a second you're hitting a wave like that because it's one after the next, after the next. And you come up on a wave and Jesus, we're going to drown. You hit the next wave. Jesus sits up and he goes, "Quiet, everybody." And the boat just goes, "Psh, psh," just like that. That's what that was like, guys. It wasn't like the storm quietly dissipated over 25 minutes. It says he rebuked it and everything was calm. And then Jesus simply says this. I love it. "Where is your faith, guys?" And Jesus went back to sleep. It doesn't say that there, but that's what I would have done. I would have just sat back, put my legs back up, put my arms over, and gone back to sleep. Just get us to the other side of the lake like I told you when we got started. Don't know what the problem is. See, we sometimes read this story and hear those words as a rebuke from Jesus, right? Where was your faith? But listen to the story play out. It's so different here, right? They wake him up. They're afraid, rightly so. They're about to die and drown. Jesus sits up, rebukes the storm. It's calm. He looks at the guys and he goes, "Guys, you got to learn to trust me, man." Puts his head back down, takes another nap. And the guys respond this way. In fear and amazement, they asked one another, "Who is this?" Right? Now, I don't think that they stood on the boat as Jesus goes, "Where is your faith? Who is that?" That's not how this plays out. Jesus sits up, he goes, "You guys got to learn to trust me," puts his head back down, and as he naps, they're sitting rowing, everything's calm, they're looking at each other, and one of them goes, "Who is he?" You know, they're whispering to each other now. And then they say this, "Who is that? He commands even the wind and the waves, and they obey him." They're amazed. They're fearful. They're a little scared. Jesus is laying in the back smiling. These guys are in for such a ride. This is just the start, right? They're asking a massive question, aren't they? Who is this behind us? Who is with us in the boat? I think Jesus sitting in the back of the boat must have had an incredible joy as he realizes what he is going to unpack for them over the next few months as they walk with him. Because Jesus is going to answer that question for them in a massive, massive, massive way. You see, for these guys, asking that question on this boat in this moment may seem a little odd to you and to me because Jesus has already raised the dead, right? He's already healed the sick, right? He's already made the blind see, right? He's already cast demons out, right? So, I mean, calming a storm, come on, that's child's play. Why are these guys so blown away by this when they've watched him raise the dead? Now, is raising the dead cooler and bigger than making a silly storm come to subside? Yes, absolutely it is. Except for one small thing. If it's real, right? But to verify raising from the dead is a tough thing to do, isn't it? To verify healing is a tough thing to do. Sometimes you can, but a lot of times it's difficult. Today, in our world, we have plenty of people on TV and all over that claim that they can heal the sick and they can raise the dead and they can cast demons out and they can do all sorts of things. And they apparently do it every day in large crowds. And why is it that we're not all flocking to go and sit under this amazement? Because as you explore the reality of a lot of this, unfortunately, a lot of it turns out to be a story that goes far beyond the reality of healing and raising the dead. Because when you're involved in that kind of stuff, does God heal the sick today? Yes. Can God raise the dead? Yes. Can God cast demons out through using one of us? Yes. Does that always happen when these guys are claiming they're doing it? No. And so the difficulty is on those kinds of miracles, they're sort of a dime a dozen many times. And you're not really sure which ones are real or not. So Jesus is on the planet. He's doing these things. The guys are certainly amazed. Don't get me wrong. They're like, wow, this guy can raise the dead. But in the back of your mind, you got to admit you're a little skeptical. I would be. But when you're on the lake in that, and a guy gets up and he goes, quiet. And it just goes, whoom. And the waves like coming at the boat. And it's like, oh, if I knew you were in the boat, I wouldn't. I'm so sorry. I'm going to sit down. I mean, it's literally like you got the waves going, sorry, that's not normal. No one does that. That's why these guys are in the boat going, who is this that can make the wind and the waves obey him? And Jesus sits in the back of the boat. And as they ask the question, he knows this. Over the next few months, he's going to say these things. I am the true vine. I am the bread of life. I am the living water. I am the way. I am the truth. I am the life. I am the resurrection. I am the light of the world. I am these things. I am creator. I am sustainer. I am God. I am king. I am Lord. I am yours. I am redeemer. I am everything. I am. He's going to tell them that over and over and over and over again so that every time they remember this story, every time they get ready to face the reality of our planet, they are going to remember that he is. He is. Who is this in the boat with us? Yes, he is. All of it. Because here's the fact. As Jesus is preparing them to go into Decapolis and other crazy places in the planet to share the reality of the gospel and the redemptive power of Jesus, he knows it's not going to be easy every day. Because Jesus does not promise us in the scriptures that when you come to know him on this planet, that your redemption will result in a diminishing of all the storms in your life, that you will get wealth, that you will get health, that you will get happiness, and that all the bad stuff will go away. And if it's not, it's only because you don't have enough faith. That is not scriptural. He does not promise any of that. He tells us, while you're on this planet, you are going to face trouble. You are going to face struggle. You are going to suffer. You are going to have the reality of sickness and difficulty and sin and hatred and everything else that makes this planet this planet. It's going to be yours to face, yes, just like everybody else. But I do promise you this, that when you are done with the mission that I've called you to display, demonstrate, and guard the reality of the gospel of Jesus Christ through the circumstances on this planet, you will have immortality, eternal life, with absolute, total, perfect, wonderful prosperity. You will be free in every way. When you leave this planet of death, you will experience life in a way you can't imagine. No pain, no struggle, no anxiety, no disease, no death, no nothing. Everything you need, everything you want, everything that is all yours. Yes, there's a promise he makes. He tells us, when we start at the top, when I'm done with you on this planet, I promise you you'll have everything you need. But while you're here, I would have taken you from this planet of death to make your redemption full if I didn't want you on mission. But I left you here because in the midst of the death that we know as this planet, I am going to use you to display and demonstrate and guard the reality of redemption in the midst of storms. So when you are in the middle of a storm and all hell is breaking loose around you, ask yourself, who is this that is in the boat with me? Who is this? Is he capable of carrying me through this storm? Because the only reason I'm in this storm is because he is allowing me to display the gospel. If he didn't need me to do that, I'd be out of here. You and I are going to face difficulties. Jesus is not here to remove them from you. He is here to redeem you now so that you can live in the freedom of that redemption through the difficulties to experience its fullness after the difficulties. And the difficulties give you and I the opportunity, frankly, the best opportunity, to display the gospel. Now, when you go out there into the real world, don't you dare underestimate the storms. They are going to be ugly. When somebody in your family gets sick and you pray for their healing and it does not come, and you watch them struggle through disease until they die, do not ever underestimate the pain and difficulty and struggle and faith-testing horror that comes with that journey. I don't. When you are in the middle of a divorce that you never intended to be in, and it was never the plan for your life, and you grew up in a Christian home, and you knew better, and you thought better, and you don't know why, and you don't understand, and how did this happen to you, and why is it you? And don't underestimate how massively painful that is. When you are struggling with losing your house and your life savings, and you're in your late 50s or early 60s, and you had a plan to retire soon and just kind of enjoy some of the fruit of your labor, and in an instant the economy wipes it out for you and you realize, I'm working till I die. Don't underestimate how difficult and painful and fearful that is. These guys did not underestimate the storm that surrounded them. They knew they were fragile. They were in a boat with an integrity issue because it's a small boat and a lot of water, and they were going to die. The problem was not that they overestimated the storm. Oh, no, they didn't. It was bad. The problem was that they underestimated who was in the boat with them. That's it. See, the storms are going to get big for you, probably. Very big. We're human. We live in a world of sin and death, and it's going to come at times, and it's going to be a difficulty for you. Sometimes God is going to heal disease right in front of you, and it's going to be extraordinary. It's going to be wonderful, just like he did in the boat. Get up and just go, stop! And sometimes he's not. Sometimes you're going to have wealth beyond your wildest imagination, and sometimes you're not. Paul says, whether rich or poor, well-fed or hungry, in prison or free, healthy or sick, it's irrelevant. Every circumstance, every relationship, every opportunity, every tragedy, every storm is given to me to display the gospel, to demonstrate the gospel, to guard the gospel. And the only way I will ever be able to live that reality out is if I remember who it is that called me, who it is that's in the boat with me, who it is that rescued me. When Jesus said to the guys, we're going to go to the other side of the lake, that's exactly what he intended to do. And it really didn't make any difference what storm was going to come up. That's where they were going. So when they woke him up and he sat up and he made the storm go away and he said, guys, I said take me to the other side of the lake. That seems simple enough, doesn't it? Just go there. So if the storm's scaring you, fine, I'll take it away. But that's not the point, is it? Point is, let's just keep going, just keep rowing, and you'll get there. This is an incredible moment, and a moment we need desperately. I hope every day when you wake up in the morning, you will start your day this week asking this question. Who is in the boat with me? Who is this that the wind and the waves obey his every command? And then you answer the question. He is King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Master over all, holds authority in all. He is master over nature, master over demons, master over disease, master over everything. He is master over life, he is master over death. And he is yours, and you are his. So whatever it is you're facing, display the gospel. Demonstrate the gospel. Guard the gospel reality that despite the storm, you're safe because he's in the boat. That's the gospel. That's the gospel. You're free. I think better than anything, that demonstrates the triumphal entry, doesn't it? Jesus is in the boat with us. We've recognized him for who he is. What more could we ask for? He ends with this at the end of his life, Matthew chapter 28, right at the very end. He's with the disciples. He's going to ascend into heaven, leave them behind to do the work. And this is what he says to them. All authority in heaven and on earth has been given to me. Therefore, go into all the world. Why do we go? It's right there. Therefore, go. Why do we go? Because all authority has been given to Jesus in heaven and on earth, because he always had it. He goes, I've got it all. There is nothing you need fear. Nothing. No storm. No difficulty. No struggle. No disease. Nothing. Because I hold all of it in my hands. And I will call you to display the gospel on this planet through it all. That is our freedom. And on this boat, that is what God reminds us of. When you go into the world, I am with you. And I am master of all. Let's pray. God, I thank you so much that as we walk into this week before us, preparing for the reality of Easter and the gospel displayed in all of its beauty, revealed to us where you abolish death and you reveal to us immortality and life. May we spend this week asking every day, who is this that is in the boat with us? And may we answer each day with a resounding I am, so that we would know once again that despite any circumstance, any obstacle, any struggle, any joy, any wonder, that we are completely safe because you are with us. And that when this life is done, as we have lived out redemption in it, that we will experience the fullness of that redemption, where all of your promises will be made beautiful. As we cross this lake of life, may we face the storms with courage, knowing that you are quietly resting on the boat with us, so that even the storm will not hurt us, because you are with us. We love you, Jesus.